How could I have been? We didn't have a plan, or if we did, I wasn't in on it. To top it all off, I was exhausted. I'd spent the night before taking care of Holmes while she came down. It had happened right after Shepard left, her falling on the bed like her strings had been cut. She'd insisted she didn't want anything, no surprise there, but I'd forced water on her and crackers one at a time from a package my father had left outside the door. It was just the two of us, silent in that dark little floral-sheeted island. She stared at the ceiling fan, her arm thrown over her face. She didn't say a word until I stood to go tell my father what we'd figured out about the school nurse. "No," Holmes said, grabbing my arm without looking at me. "Stay here. You've solved it," I told her. "You don't need to haul her in. Let the police do that." "I still have more work to do. I need to figure out what part she plays in this, how the Moriartys have been using her." She held on tighter. "This isn't some jewel robbery. This is the woman who's killed one person and tried to kill another, not to mention trying to ruin our lives, if not end those two. So yes, I will bloody well haul her in." I should have pressed my case. I should have insisted. But I was exhausted, and she was exhausted, and so I didn't try. Jamie Watson, he didn't. I sat back down on the floor and put my head against the mattress. The hours passed that way, day slipping into night, until I fell asleep, kneeling by her bedside like a pilgrim before some entombed saint. There wasn't the barest hint of sun coming through the window when Holmes shook me awake, hustled me into my clothes and down to my father's car. I hadn't spoken a word. "Tea," she said, pressing a mug into my hands from the passenger seat. "Now drive, before anyone realizes we've gone." As I blearily gripped the steering wheel, reminding myself that I needed to be on the right side of the road, not the left, that this wasn't England, Holmes kept up a low, unending monologue, sorting the last few months through this lens of Bryony's guilt. Well, probable guilt. If it turned out that an entirely different English Bryony was our school nurse, I'd be the first to pack it in and just go home. "She's only gotten more desperate as she's gone along. She's dropped the conceit of hanging us with our own history, which, personally speaking, was the only part of her campaign that I found at all interesting. Come on, explosions, really?" At this point, I was parking the car. "There was nothing interesting about explosions. She ruined a perfectly good lab that I had painstakingly assembled, bit by bit, from things I'd taken from Mr. Lamar's biology room. Oh, don't look at me like that. I've seen you toast marshmallows on those burners. You're just as guilty as I am. And really, the only thing I'll miss were my copies of your great-great-great-grandfather's stories. Categorically worthless." She led me down Sherrinford's main drag to the side street that held Bryony's flat. "Honestly, I think they're being given away for free on Kindle, but I did love them. And she has footage of you naked, most likely, which I can't even begin to unravel the child pornography laws on that one." I was having trouble understanding Holmes's relentlessly chipper mood. We'd spent the day before in hell, and okay, we were about to engage in a little breaking and entering, which, honestly, I was pretty excited for too, but we hadn't even acknowledged anything that had happened the day before. No apologies on either side, no real conclusion to the fight. No acknowledgement of whatever it was that had passed between us under the porch. And here she was, arm tucked in my elbow like the day, it felt like years ago, I first introduced her to my father. I turned to say something, I don't know what, and I saw her face. Relief. She was relieved. Somewhere deep, deep down, she had suspected August Moriarty. She'd been too well trained to ignore it. And now she had good reason to pull her focus away from him and put his fiancée in her crosshairs instead. I quickly debated with myself how I should react to this realization. Jealousy? Disapproval? And decided I was tired of feeling like shit. I might as well cheer up too. Maybe she'd let me pick the lock. "Holmes," I said. We were standing on the corner of Market and Green, peering down the block at Bryony's flat above the flower store. It was all very picturesque, with its painted window boxes and iron scrollwork. It didn't look like the flat of someone who had killed a boy in cold blood. "Were you going to tell me why we're here so early? Her interview at the station isn't until 10, and it's just 8 now. Bryony will be out the door by 8:30, hair all done, looking like a starlet. She'll stop by the Starbucks outside town. She'll maybe go shopping. She thinks this is a routine set of questions, not an all-day event. Anyone who uses a vanity font on a death threat is far too confident to think they're under suspicion. She was almost bouncing on her heels. I got into the police database this morning and got the make and model of her car. Registered to Bryony Downs, one black 2009 Toyota RAV4, license 223APK. Or that car right there. It was parked on the street outside her flat. In the meantime, we are going to sit very inconspicuously in the cafe here until she leaves. And if all goes well, we'll have you to your 10:30 appointment to collect your things, because those jeans are beginning to smell a bit ripe. I wasn't sure I could survive Cheerful Holmes any more than I could her junky alter ego. All the same, I let her drag me by the arm into the cafe, where she set us up with two teas by the window. It all happened as she'd predicted. Bryony emerged in red lipstick and sunglasses like an old movie star. Holmes told me not to be so obvious, but I couldn't help but stare at her as she drove past. That shining blonde hair, the way she was singing along to the radio. I almost could have believed she wasn't guilty then, because it was clear the consequences of her actions hadn't made the slightest impression. She'd put an innocent girl in the hospital. She'd taken Dobson's life. Even someone as disgusting as Dobson deserved the chance to grow up and become a better person. Bryony Downs should be lying on her bathroom floor, racked with guilt, and instead, she decided that she was the star of her own romantic comedy. Holmes held us back another 10 minutes. "Patience is virtue, Watson," she said. "Besides, she might have forgotten something." When the coast remained clear, it only took us moments to get to the front door, leading up to both Bryony's flat and the one above it. It was unlocked. As we crept up the steps, I said a quiet thank you for not having to pick her locked door right there on the street. When we reached it, number 2, like the mailbox by her door, printed Bryony Downs, I went down on one knee to inspect the lock. "It's a Yale," I said casually, "like the ones I practiced on with you. Do you think I could..." With a disgusted sound, Holmes turned the knob. "I see that you're still scratching your locks," she said to the man sitting there. 10. I didn't understand what I was looking at. The room in front of us was almost empty, as in no tables, no sofas, no rugs, nails where pictures used to hang. Empty. From where I stood, I had the clear view through a doorway to where two dark-suited men with Bluetooth earpieces were methodically sorting through boxes of breakfast cereal. One at a time, they opened them, dumped their contents in a bowl, and then tossed it all into a garbage bag. One of them actually whistled while he worked. It was distinctly possible that I had dreamed myself into a surrealist film, or that Holmes was pulling some elaborate prank. I might have even believed it, too, if it wasn't for the man sitting in front of us. He, or one of his minions, had dragged a velvet-tufted chair into the center of the bare room, but he wasn't sitting on it the way you'd have expected. He didn't cross his legs or lean lazily into the wing of the chair, stretching out one arm to check the time on his admittedly very nice watch. Those poses wouldn't have worked on him anyway. The man was too much of a nerd. A handsome nerd, a very sleek, well-dressed nerd, but a nerd nonetheless. Instead, he sat at the edge of his ridiculous chair, tidily smoking a cigarette. I sized him up. That was clearly what he wanted, presenting himself in the empty room like an art exhibit. Buddy Holly glasses, a 60s ad man haircut, a hard side part tapered at the sides, and, from what I could tell, his suit was straight off Savile Row, where James Bond would get fitted for a bespoke jacket, if he were real. Holmes had said he was pudgy, but what I saw instead was a sort of softness from hours spent in front of a computer screen. None of this would have been all that remarkable on its own, but written invisibly all over him, like white ink on white paper, was power. Electric power. The kind that snapped its fingers and brought a government to its knees. What had Holmes said? MI5? Google, private security. How much of that was true? Drones, I thought uneasily. He controlled drones. And I was the genius that had brought him here. "Where are Nurse Bryony's things?" I asked, trying to sound like I knew the answer already and was just asking to confirm. Milo Holmes ignored me. "I don't scratch locks," he said in a sonorous voice, smooth where his sister's was rough. "That was my man, Peterson. Wanted to have a go. I thought there wasn't any harm. We weren't in a rush." He'd had all of 10 minutes to clean out the living room. I hadn't even seen him go in the door. No rush. Right. "You're very kind, sir," one of the men said from the back and resumed whistling. They were cracking open Bryony's eggs now. Holmes crossed her arms. "You do scratch. Every time. I do a very pretty one, as you well know. You should have waited for us." He drew on his cigarette.
"You look better than I was expecting. My sources led me to believe that it was very bad this time."
I swallowed.
"Yes, well, it's much less razor blades and 3 a.m. phone calls now, isn't it? And much more saving my own neck from the noose."
It was easy for me to imagine them as children. Milo, inexorable as a tank, and Holmes, the dervish, circling him. She was so restrained most of the time. But when she wasn't, well...
Then she said things like,
"Tell me right now what you have done with my evidence, or I will tell Mother about you spying on our fencing instructor in the shower."
"You won't, and you know very well what I've done with your evidence."
Holmes cast one hateful look around the room.
"New York, honestly, you've missed all the important parts. I was handling this. It was handled."
"Handle August Moriarty's ex-fiancé? Lottie, really?"
"Lottie," I thought gleefully, despite myself.
"Lottie, you're emotional. You really should have left this to the adults. Now that this idea of Mother's has run its course, let's bring you home. Boarding school? All wrong. We'll put you in the London flat. I'm sure I could convince Professor de Marchelier to tutor you."
"Milo, he hates me, and..."
"No, you aren't thinking. What if they try to throw you in jail? Americans with their prisons. My men would get you out before that, of course, but such a hassle. You always did like the skiing in Utah. I would want you to be able to come back. I'd want that for you."
It was becoming abundantly clear why Holmes didn't want her family involved. Emotional. Leaving things to the adults. Sending her away. Skiing? I was an idiot for calling him in. He could go straight to hell.
"I'd like to know what you've done with the evidence," I said. It came out as a growl. "And how you knew to be here at this flat."
Milo arched an eyebrow.
"Is this your bulldog?" he asked Holmes. There wasn't any venom in it, but that didn't make it better.
"This," Holmes said, "is James Watson, my friend and colleague, and you will give him an answer."
I stood up a bit straighter.
"My sister asked me a question yesterday," Milo said. "Do you know the last time that happened?"
"November 2009.
Lottie doesn't ask questions. She deduces and decides for herself. That alone would be enough to get me on a plane, particularly when that question has to do with a Moriarty. Thankfully, I was headed to New York already. And as for her things..."
This nurse..."
He said nurse the way you'd say gelatinous slug.
"This bank of flats has a very nice little alley behind it, and we sent away her possessions by armored car right as you walked in. My men at Greystone HQ in the city will sort through them, determine the appropriate angle, and return them to your detective Ben Shepherd."
"By the city, he means New York," Holmes said, not taking her eyes off her brother. "And by Greystone, he means the mercenary company currently raising the Middle East, which he owns, Greystone, that is, and which apparently works as his personal honor guard, if the breakfast nights back there are any indication."
"Glad to be of service," Peterson called.
The other one grunted.
"You know, none of this explains the Moriarty agent practicing your handwriting," Milo said conversationally.
"No," Holmes said. "But my ruining August's life does. His fiancée's decided to play Avenging Angel on his behalf."
"Two separate people out to get you," he mused.
You really are popular. I'm just not sure why you won't come to the obvious conclusion that the two of them are working together, that this Bryony Downs creature is in August Moriarty's employ. Holmes set her chin.
Fine, Lottie, Milo sighed. We'll focus on the nurse, at least for now.
How is any of this efficient? I asked him, changing the subject. What is this woman going to do when she returns and finds out her things are gone?
Milo coughed politely to hide his laugh. We'll have proof enough before her interview with Detective Shepherd is over to have him charge her with murder.
And you know the facts of the case, I said. You know what you're looking for in her things.
Obviously, he said.
Will you come up with real proof, I asked, or manufacture it?
Milo spread his hands wordlessly.
Do you have to ask? Holmes said to me.
Well, now that that's settled, take this, Milo said, handing me his cigarette. I want to text Uncle Leander the adorable thing you just said about James.
Watson, she and I said together.
Of course, he said. Friend and colleague. I love it.
Holmes snatched the phone away. So that's it? I asked, grinding his cigarette out on the floor. Is this the end? Detective Shepherd gets a confession out of Bryony Davis Downs, and you take her stuff off to be freelance police and, what, roll credits?
It appears so, Holmes said.
Already she was beginning to slump into herself, something I identified now with back porches and mud and pain pill misery. I put a hand on her shoulder. I couldn't think of anything else to do. She looked at it and then up at me. Slowly the color returned to her face. The corners of her mouth pulled up into a smile, one that stayed.
Peterson, she called. Won't you tell your colleague there, yes, you with the Persian cat in the basement flat in Berlin, to call the armored truck and have them turn around? I want everything back in this room just as it was. I suppose you took photographs of the original, or you're a bigger fool than I'd imagined, disrupting the crime scene as you have. Really, why on earth would you have moved it to your headquarters, except to allow this would-be Orson Welles? Sorry, Milo, you're not handsome enough to be Olivier, to pose in an empty room. How dull.
I bit my lip against my smile.
What I could have told you from the dust trails alone would have solved this case, she continued. As you've utterly ruined that possibility, I want any powders or creams you find brought straight to me. Cosmetics, of course, but do look for jars marked as protein powder, any wires or tools, anything to suggest a bomb. And I want the receiver for whatever tracker you've affixed to Bryony's car. Give it to me. No, bring it here.
She held out an impatient hand. I want to make sure that she's actually arriving at her appointment, and not, oh, dashing to the airport and then on to Fiji and thereafter gone.
Have I missed anything, Watson?
As she examined the tracker she'd been handed, I made a show of surveying the room. Were you going to tell him about the molted snakeskin under the chair cushion he's sitting on, or should I? With an undignified yelp, Milo leapt to his feet.
Oh, yes, Holmes said blandly. That. Peterson, do check the walls for a rattlesnake.
The two Greystone grunts busily rearranged the furniture to Holmes's specifications. Milo watched the proceedings, arms crossed, with a faint air of distaste. That is, he appeared to, if you didn't look closely.
I did. I'd learned to do that much.
Whenever Milo's hard gaze fell on his sister, it softened the slightest bit. He could have stopped Peterson and Michaels at any point, ordered Bryony's place stripped bare again, frog-marched Holmes onto the nearest London-bound plane. He didn't. He stood and watched his sister work. It seemed safe enough for me to take the few minutes to gather my things from the dorm. Holmes had put me in charge of watching the GPS tracker on Bryony's car, and other than two quick stops for coffee and for gas, she'd driven a straight course to the police station. There wasn't really much else I could do, and honestly, I was looking forward to getting a clean set of my own clothes.
I'll be back, I told her.
She nodded and kept on directing traffic. The day had turned out to be mild, so I left my father's car parked on the street and walked the half mile up to campus. I was suffused with a sense of well-being, the kind I associated with waking up late on a lazy Sunday, no plans, no obligations. I had no doubts that Holmes would find the necessary evidence to implicate Briony Downs for every terrible thing that had happened. It was over. Over. And Charlotte Holmes and I were still here. I let myself daydream about spending Christmas break with her in London. Hopefully Holmes would be at her family's flat there for the month, but if not, I'd jailbreak her from a Sussex myself. We'd go get a proper curry, first thing, and then I'd take her to my favorite second-hand bookshop, the one where the owner had asked me to sign my great-great-great-grandfather's books. Maybe she'd want to see a violin program at Royal Albert Hall. And after that, I'd ask her to show me her personal London, the one she'd memorized as a child. We'd see how it had changed and grown in our absence, the way cities do. We'd both have to get to know it again as our London. As I crossed the quad to Missioner Hall, I couldn't help but notice how bare Sherringford was. The Sciences Building was in ruins, still smoking faintly under the black tarp they'd thrown over the roof. That woman had wanted Holmes dead, I thought with a shiver. It hadn't really hit me until then. Briony Downs had wanted to end Holmes's life. Thank God we were done with it. I was a few minutes early, but Tom was already waiting on the steps of our dorm, shivering in his thin jacket. We both looked a little threadbare, I thought, me in my father's coat, Tom in his raggedy sweater vest. It was surprisingly good to see him, Argyle and all. "Hey," he said brightly, "where have you guys been? At your dad's house? And Charlotte's okay. I've been trying to call you, but it kept going straight to voicemail." I told him about the cell phone I'd abandoned on my desk. He'd been evacuated straight from the library, he said, and put on a bus to that Days Inn without anyone telling them what had happened. "We'd heard the explosion," he said. "People were crying. It was awful. But we got filled in eventually. For the first day, it was like a church in there. Now it's a total shit show. People climbing the walls. Lots of rumors. Like, what really happened in the science building? Do you have any insider info?" "No, tell me inside. I said a silent thank you as the front doors opened, cutting him off. A bored-looking policeman consulted a clipboard. "Thomas Bradford, James Watson, come with me. The building's secure, but they're having us stay with you as a precaution." In my haste the other night, I'd forgotten to lock our door or even fully close it. The policeman frowned at me when a slight push threw it open. When he saw what was inside it, his hand went for his gun. It really did look like a crime scene. The slit mattress and the torn-up curtains and the hollowed-out books. The glint of broken glass over everything. "It's fine, officer," I said. "I had an accident with the mirror right before we were evacuated." "Doesn't look fine," he grumbled, but stayed outside. I turned to Tom to apologize, to explain. He'd be shocked, I thought. Maybe he'd want to make a statement to Detective Shepard. After all, he'd been recorded too. All the blood had drained from his face except for two bright spots of color, one on each cheek. His eyes had gone all pupil. He blinked rapidly, staring at the floor. "Tom," I said as gently as I could. I hadn't meant to scare him this badly. He jerked his head up to look at me. "When did this happen?" The phrasing caught me off guard. Not what, but when. "The night we were evacuated," I said cautiously. "Was it Nurse Briony?" I startled, then remembered that I'd told him about my concussion in the infirmary. "I don't know," it seemed the safest answer. He went a shade paler and nodded to himself, as senselessly fast as a bobblehead doll. 5 minutes, the policeman called. "Hey," I said to Tom. "I promise I'll explain later, but can we..." "Where are they?" he asked in a snarl, shoving me into the door of my closet. His cheerful, bright American face looked like an ugly mask. "Where the fuck are they, Jamie?" It was like the floor fell open below us. I shoved him off me and kept him there, an arm's length away. Tears welled up in his eyes as he struggled against my grip. "What the hell are you talking about?" But I knew exactly what he was talking about. I just wanted to hear him say it. Admit that he'd bugged our room. confess that all this time his friendly gossip-mongering was a cover for collecting information for Bryony Downs.
"Oh my God, he's gonna kill me!" Tom stopped fighting me off.
He fell back, gasping, throwing his hands up over his face, and I felt a flare of satisfaction. That faded as quickly as it came.
He? The dealer? The Moriarty dealer?
2 minutes, the policeman said. Cut the dramatics and finish packing.
Talk fast, I said, pulling my suitcase out from under the bed and yanking armfuls of clothes from the dresser.
I never even got anything good, Tom said as if to himself.
Nothing conclusive. Charlotte even stopped coming to the room. You two were always hunkered down in our fucked up little dungeon.
I can't deal with this right now.
I grabbed the novels from above my bed and dropped them on top of my clothes. 1, 2, 3, like grenades. Textbooks, soap. I had to get in my closet, but Tom was still slouched in front of it.
Move, I said to him, but he stared up at me stupidly and the bovine look on him eroded the last of my temper.
I swear to God, I will break your neck if you don't move. I might break your neck anyway.
You were spying on me, Tom. On top of all the other awful shit happening, you had to make it worse. I never did anything to you.
He offered to split his advance with me, he said. He already sold it, you know. He's in the middle of writing it now. It's going to be huge. He's going to have all this money. He'll be famous. He'll finally be able to teach somewhere better than this shithole. His friend Penelope is going to get him a job at Yale.
I stared at him, at his horrible, lying mouth.
Wheatley? You're full of shit. The dealer told you to say that.
Tom went to his desk and opened the bottom drawer, pulled out a battered legal pad. The top page didn't have any writing on it. Not actual writing, no. Someone had painstakingly colored in the indentations made by the words written on the page above.
Skeletons in her office, he says starrily, as if he's in love with death as much as her.
Lines and lines of florid prose.
He wears the glasses of a beat philosopher from the 1950s, but his face is all Cornwall smooth. When they dance, they do not touch. They were Mr. Wheatley's notes from our meeting, when he'd so impressed me by interrogating me and then handing over what he'd written down. I remembered the piece of cardboard he'd stuck below the top page. The top 2 pages. I thought at the time that he was worried his ink would bleed through, but he had just been making himself a copy.
He was sure you were guilty, Tom said, almost like he was pleading with me.
Back in October, I was waiting for an appointment with him to talk about my story, and I heard him say it to another teacher inside his office. You, guilty. And I told him, no, you weren't, and it was actually this great story, you and Charlotte Holmes solving crimes, that you two were totally boning like Bonnie and Clyde, the good guy version. He had this idea for a book, True Crime, with famous kids as the heroes. The public would eat it up. I'm a good writer. He told me that. Better than you, anyway. Even if my family's not famous, and I'd do a good job helping, and you'd be happy about it in the end when you saw how much attention it got you.
He cut himself off.
So you bugged our room.
He had me do it. Ordered all the stuff online. The mirror was the worst, replacing it.
But yeah, I'd get you to talk, and then I'd review the files when you were gone. Write everything down. Pass it along to him.
But look at this. He's never gonna pay me now.
Why? I asked him again. I thought Tom was my friend. He was one of the only constants in my life. His irrepressible grin and his motor mouth and his ridiculous sweater vest. We watched stupid videos on his computer at night. We ate each other's candy, borrowed each other's shampoo. He was the first person who was nice to me. When I came back to America, miserable and alone.
I was doing you a favor, he repeated, like he was trying to make himself believe it.
Time, boys, the officer boomed from the doorway.
I slammed the door in his face and bolted it. I was going to get an explanation, even if it got me arrested.
Tell me why.
Lena's family goes to Paris every summer,
Tom said quietly as the policeman hammered on the door. She invited me, and she expects things from me. Dinner's out, presents. You know her dad's a big oil tycoon out in India. They have a housekeeper, and she has her own plane, and I'm here from the Midwest on scholarship. Do you know what that feels like? He was going to give me 10 grand. I couldn't wring out an ounce of sympathy for him. Seriously, what do you think Alina will say when she finds out how you got that money? Jesus Christ, everyone at this fucking school acts like they're so rich, and half of them aren't, not even close. When are you going to realize that? What do you think all those people are doing at Holmes's poker game every week, wagering all their money? Here's a solution. Get the hell over yourself. Tell Lena the truth. God, she's actually a decent person. Do you think she'd really care? I didn't expect you to understand it. You're a show dog with a pedigree. I'm just someone that escaped from the pound. He shook his head. It's not like I hurt you or anything. You're my friend. I was doing you a favor. It was going to make you famous. Open up the door. Open it up. I was disgusted with him, disgusted with Sherringford, with the bullshit and the jealousy and the backstabbing. Furious, I grabbed the handles of my closet doors, ready to throw the rest of the stuff in my suitcase and get the fuck out of Dodge. Something bit into my skin. I looked down stupidly. My hands were so cut up and bandaged that I could hardly tell what had happened. There, a pinprick of blood near the knuckle of my index finger. I didn't think anything of it, not until I gripped the handle with the bandaged part of my hand and flung open the door. Clothes and shoes and the rest of my life's detritus, all in a jumble on the closet floor. On the back wall were 3 giant, jagged lines in marker. You have 24 hours to live unless she gives me what I want. XOXO, Culverton Smith. Culverton Smith. The man behind Sherlock Holmes's poisoned ivory box. I stared back down at my bleeding knuckle. Behind me, Tom raised his iPhone with one shaking hand and took a picture. I ripped the infected spring from the door handle, took my phone from the desk, dead, and its charger, picked up my suitcase. The whole time, Tom was loudly pleading his ignorance. This wasn't me. I wouldn't do something like that. Like the swine he was, until I grabbed him by the shirt with one hand. This is what you can do for me, I snarled at him. Deal with the cop. His eyes were focused on the pinprick of infected blood on his shirt. But what should I say? Make something up. You're good at that. As I stalked down the hall, I heard Tom's half-assed babbling. It's my fault, he was saying to the policeman. It's my fault. Let him go. I made it to the front doors before my legs began to give out under me. Bryony Downs had won. She'd taken the adventure of the dying detective and turned it back on us with deadly earnest, not knowing that Charlotte Holmes had used that same story to clear our names. I had no idea what she'd dabbed that spring with, but my brain was supplying a cavalcade of answers. Spinal meningitis, I thought, or malaria. I used to want to be a doctor. I'd wanted to treat the scariest diseases, and now I couldn't stop running them through my head. Milo was right. She had to be working with the Moriartys. How else could she have access to this sort of thing? She was a puppet, and this was a message directed at the Holmes family. And the message was going to be my dead body. I staggered out the front door and down the steps. The next 2 students were waiting for the officer to fetch them, and one of them stepped forward to help me. Don't touch me, I said, holding up a hand. I might be contagious. Because that was the worst of it. Nurse Bryony could have made me into some kind of bomb, a patient zero that could take out the whole eastern seaboard. I needed to get inside, away from everyone, and I had to start making a plan. My parents couldn't know. There was nothing they could do. I wondered if my father would still find all this crime-solving fun after he identified my corpse at the morgue. No, I wasn't going to die. I was 16 years old. I was going to be a writer. I was going to go to college,
get a flat in London or Edinburgh or Paris. I'd get to know my stepbrothers. Oh, God, I didn't want my little sister to be an only child. I didn't want to leave Charlotte Holmes with a controlling family and a brilliant mind and a dead best friend. I didn't want to imagine her life without me. Maybe it was selfish to think that way, but I couldn't imagine mine without her. The sky was open and blue, guileless in its beauty, and the snow everywhere blinding. The light was beginning to prick at my eyes, and I rubbed at them with the back of my hand. This had to be psychosomatic, I told myself. It had to be in my head, the denial working its hand around me. I can't possibly be dying, I thought, and tried to believe it. One foot, then the other. Where was I going? I'd walked, I remembered, up the hill from town. The distance was impossibly far. I'd sit for a minute, catch my breath. If I could just arrange my suitcase. There. Holmes told me that, when they found me, I'd passed out in a snowbank. They bundled me into the back of Milo's town car, her and her brother and his greystone mercenaries. Blankets, something hot to drink. Holmes rubbing my chilled hands between hers, strangely smooth and firm. No, I'd managed to say. The blood, it's contagious. And then I saw that she was wearing latex gloves. She knew. I was racked with chills, and still cold sweat beaded on my forehead before trickling down my face. My mouth burned, my teeth tender to the touch. I couldn't swallow. My throat didn't work. Holmes held a bottle of water to my lips and tipped it gently into my mouth. I tried to pull off my shirt, thinking in my delirium that it was a straitjacket, and she stilled my hands. All the while, Milo watched me from behind his glasses, taking copious notes on his phone. On what, I didn't know. I was a specimen, I thought wildly. I would be experimented on until I died. When we got to our destination, Peterson had to carry me up the stairs over his shoulder like he'd rescued me from a burning building. And then there was a bed, with sheets still warm from the dryer, a table beside it. Peterson returned to that table again and again with pill bottles, clean rags. Someone brought in an IV drip and put it into my arm. What was real, I didn't know. Milo came in a suit and watch chain. He lit a pipe by the window, staring broodingly out over the rooftops. My dog Maggie was there too, though she died when I was 6. But she put her shaggy head on my mattress and looked up at me with big wet eyes, telling me in silent words what my sister Shelby was reading that week, A Wrinkle in Time, how much my mother missed me. My hands were made of lead. I couldn't ruffle her ears the way I wanted. Good dog, I wanted to say. Where have you been? Bryony came in through an invisible door and put her arm around Milo's waist. They talked as if I wasn't there.
Lead him up to the mountain and put the dagger to his throat, Milo said in his sonorous voice.
I thought we were done with goats. I thought we only made offerings of sheep. Still, Bryony smiled into his face. He kissed her like they were in a movie, dipping her back in his arms. Stop, I yelled. Stop! But she was at my bedside, with a pillow pressed down over my face to keep the words inside my mouth. And then she was gone, and Milo was too, and I was alone. I didn't trust anything that was happening to me. Where was Holmes? For that matter, where was I? But I was so overwhelmed by a wave of exhaustion that I let myself be carried away by it all the way to sea. When I fully woke, night had fallen. As my eyes adjusted to the dark, I noticed things I hadn't before. There was a dim lamp by my bed, its mouth turned away to throw a white circle on the wall. Beside me, a machine counted out my pulse, reading it from a plastic clip attached to my index finger. My hands had been rebandaged, expertly this time. I felt present in my body, in a way I hadn't since I opened that closet door. There was a bright blanket at the end of my bed, a door across from me. In the shadowed corner was a chair. Empty, I thought, and as I squinted to make sure, I saw the velvet fabric, the tufted buttons. I was in Bryony Downs's flat.
Frantically, I pulled myself up in bed, yanking the heart monitor off my finger and going to work on the medical tape over the needles on my arm. She'd taken me. She'd taken me somewhere. Had Holmes and her brother been hallucinations, too? The heart monitor screamed a warning, and the door across from me flew open. By the time she came in, I was on my feet, panting, the desk lamp ripped out of the wall and brandished like a weapon before me.
"Watson!" Holmes cried from the doorway. "Watson! God, I thought you were dead!"
It took some doing, but I let her coax me back into bed. She called a name I didn't recognize, and a man in scrubs came in and put my IV back in. He took my vitals while Holmes hovered behind him, biting her lip. She pulled her hair back roughly from her face. Her nose was red, her face white. She looked ascetic and harsh. She looked, in fact, like she'd been crying. I started to reach out to touch her, but then drew back my hand.
"Right now, we're managing your symptoms," the doctor murmured. "We've given you medication to control the pain and to bring your fever down. Don't try to get up. If you need to use the bathroom, let us know."
I nodded. Now that the adrenaline rush was over, my legs were trembling from my attempt at self-defense.
"You shouldn't be here, Charlotte," the doctor said. "He could be contagious, and I don't want you touching him."
Stepping forward, she took my hand in hers.
"So be it," the doctor said, and left.
"Holmes," I asked her.
"What did she give me?
How did you know?" She hoisted herself up on my bedside. I remembered the night I'd woken her this way, when she'd fallen asleep as Haley and woken up again as my best friend. We'd had pancakes. She'd asked me to trust her.
"It's a created virus," she said hoarsely. "Brewed in a lab. That doctor, Dr. Warner, is a specialist on this particular strain."
She rattled off a series of Latin words I didn't know.
"That's what it's called."
"Can you give me something easier to call it?" I asked, half-joking.
"The Watson flu?"
She shrugged.
"As you'd like. It was created originally as a bioweapon for the rapidity with which it kills its victims. Dr. Warner works for the German government. Luckily for us, he was presenting at a conference in Washington. Milo more or less had him clubbed over the head and brought up here."
"Oh," I said.
"So it can be cured?"
Holmes bit her lip again. I'd never seen her so ragged.
"We think so," she said carefully. "He has some theories. Right now he's in the other room, researching."
"The other room? Here, in Bryony's flat?"
"It was my idea," she admitted. "God knows she won't be returning here after pulling a stunt like this, and I didn't want to bring you to your house, not contagious like this. So we took this place over, changed the locks. Milo called in some favors, as you can see. We'll bring in a professional cleaning crew, of course, after this is all over. The next tenant doesn't deserve to get the Watson flu in the bargain. After this is all over..."
One way or another, it would be over soon. She caught my gaze, and with that magician's trick of hers, I watched her read my mind. She shook her head quickly, hugging her arms around herself.
"You can't do that," I said quietly. "You can't fall apart yet."
She nodded, her face turned from me.
"Come here," I said, moving over in the bed.
"If you really don't mind my being patient, Zero." She swallowed her tears. I pulled back the sheet, and she crawled in beside me, putting her head on my chest. I pressed my lips against the dark crown of her hair. It was like those hours under the porch, the stillness, the waiting. And it was nothing like it at all. My muscles ached. My limbs were heavy. My lungs were raw in my chest. I had to brace myself against the bed as another round of shivers ground their way through me.
"How did you know?"
I asked, gritting my teeth.
"About the virus. About what happened to me." "Bryony sent me a list of her demands," she said, her voice muffled in my shirt. "Via text, of course. She had it timed to your appointment at Mishner Hall. Must have gotten the schedule from the old campus email."
"Via text? Holmes, that can be used as evidence against her."
"That's not what we're going to do."
"But..."
"Don't, Watson."
I didn't have the strength to argue with her.
"What were her demands? What does she want?
A pony, she said. I smiled against the pain. The very prettiest pony in the land, on a golden lead. Only then will the favorite sidekick be cured.
You're not my sidekick, Holmes said softly. That's her first mistake.
What am I, then? But I didn't know if I wanted to hear the answer. Not now. She must have heard the reticence in my voice.
A pony, she said. And $3 million and safe passage to Russia, a country which, given my father's history as well as the current state of U.S.-Russo relations, won't extradite her to either Britain or America to stand trial for what she's done, which would be moot anyway because she wants me to claim full responsibility for Dobson's murder and Elizabeth's attack. Jesus Christ, I struggled against the idea. She's done the thing very completely, Holmes said. There was a touch of admiration in her voice. I should have known. This is not your fault, I told her before she could go on. You claiming it's your fault makes it sound like I'm just a piece of cargo getting hauled next to you. No will of my own. So stop it.
But
I'm dying, I told her with a grim sort of glee. You have to listen to me. She laughed hollowly.
Milo has the money, and he's arranging the airfare as we speak. I've written out my confession. It's done. The exchange will be made at 9 o'clock in the morning. She has the antidote. I don't know how. Dr. Warner doesn't know how it's possible, but she does. And even if she's lying, it's still a chance we have to take. We're meeting her 22 hours after your infection, so you should still be... It should be fine.
Where...
She'll text us the location when it's time.
You're not going to jail for this, I said. Detective Shepherd won't let you.
Wait, isn't she in his custody? What the hell happened there?
Remember when we thought she stopped for gas? She switched cars at the police station, left a Toyota in the lot and picked up another car that she'd left there. Again, that note of admiration. We saw her as a stupid sorority girl, and she ran circles around us.
And where is he now, Detective Shepherd?
Her terms were no police involvement, no sending you to the hospital. So I don't know. I've been focused on you.
I felt her shrug.
That's the other part. You'll die. One way or another, you'll die if I don't take this fall. I think it's a good idea to listen to her, as she's proven herself handy with a suitcase bomb.
The door cracked open and Milo stuck his glossy head in. If he was surprised to see his sister tucked in my arms, he didn't show it.
"You're awake. How are you feeling?" he asked.
Like I'd been run down by a truck.
"Fine," I said.
"Do you want us to contact your parents?"
Oh, God. My father thought...
"Thinks you are discussing strategy with myself and Lottie until late tonight. This afternoon, Peterson and Michaels returned his car and gave him my reassurances. As we've decided to broker with Nurse Bryony for your cure, you don't have a real reason to worry him, though I understand how one's parents could be a comfort in a time like this." He said the last part academically, like it was a theory he'd never personally tested.
"Right," I said, trying to keep my voice even.
"No, that's fine. Don't contact them."
"Get some sleep," he advised. "We'll handle this."
If I wasn't included in that we, and how could I be, I couldn't even handle standing up. At least his sister was. I nodded at him, and he nodded back and shut the door.
"You're not going to jail," I said again. My mouth felt dry.
"There has to be another way. I need to be arrested and convicted, or she'll find another way to end you." She was very specific on those terms.
"Holmes...
Watson," she said roughly. "I remember a very recent conversation where you detailed all the horrible possibilities of my death. Do you remember that? Would you like to, for just a moment, imagine what it would be like to watch one come true? Think about what this is like for me. The trade-off shouldn't be spending the rest of your life in a cell for a crime you didn't commit."
"No,"
she curled my shirt into her fist.
"No, but perhaps I should serve time for the crime I did."
"I can't talk about your martyr complex right now," I said, swallowing against the sand in my throat.
I can't.
I reached blindly for the glass of water by the bed and drank it down. She drew back to look at me.
You're flushed, she said, scrambling to her feet. I think your fever's returning. I'll fetch Dr. Warner.
Wait,
I said. She was rumpled, undone, her hair coming out of its elastic to curl in tendrils around her face. There was something I had to say to her, I thought. Something necessary, something right at the tip of my tongue. I guess she knew it before I did. Leaning over, she smoothed my hair back from my forehead. I closed my eyes at her touch. And so it was a surprise when she kissed me on the lips. She smelled unexpectedly like roses.
That's all I can do, she whispered, resting her forehead to mine.
That's a lot, I said, and she laughed.
No, I mean, that's all. It's nearly too much for me to touch anyone after Dobson and I. For you, I'm trying.
I could feel her breath on my lips.
I don't know how long I'll be like this, she said slowly. Or if I've maybe been this way all along. I don't know if it'll ever be enough.
It was confusing what she said, but I thought I understood it.
You don't have to try, I said to her. Whatever this is already, it's already enough.
I know, she said, straightening.
It has to be.
We looked at each other for a minute.
If you get yourself thrown in jail over this, I told her, I will never, never forgive you. You need to find another way, or I swear to God I will die on you just out of spite.
Her flickering smile.
Okay.
Okay? It's that simple?
Okay, she said again.
I had no choice but to believe her.
Your pulse is racing and you're far too warm. I'm going for Dr. Warner.
She smirked.
Don't want you to die before you can use it as a bargaining chip.
Thanks, I said, pleased at last that she chalked my hammering heart up to my fever. 11. I was much, much worse in the morning. It shouldn't have come as a surprise. Logic dictates that a deteriorating illness deteriorates, but then logic is hard to come by when you're dying. Whatever brief reprieve Dr. Warner's drugs had granted me ended around midnight when I maxed out on the highest morphine dosage he'd allow me. The hours after that were, well, I've been assured it's best that I can't remember them. As morning broke, I moved in and out of fitful dreams, dark, sodden landscapes that were at once cruelly hot and cut through by the bitterest winds. At the same time, I was conscious of something happening in the room around me, a hand on my forehead, a pair of voices shouting. It all added to my unrest, since for the life of me I couldn't make myself understand what was happening. Burma, I thought. I was in Burma. I was in Afghanistan. No, my mother was baking cinnamon rolls in the kitchen, and if I was very good, if I made my bed and put all my toys away, she'd bring them in to me. Holmes was there too, dressed in all black. Someone had died. We were headed to the funeral.
I woke to the barest hint of sunlight through the curtains. My room was silent. I could tell that much without opening my eyes. The effort I had to put into even that simple task left me dizzy and sweating. When I managed it, I realized that I was alone. Was this another hallucination? It didn't feel like one. There was the bedside table, there the tufted chair, and I wasn't in any pain. I turned my head to look at the morphine drip. That took another eternity. But I didn't understand how to read the dosage on the bag. Whatever I was being given, it was working. In place of the pain, there was a sort of bodily rebellion. I asked my legs to swing off the bed. They didn't. I asked my arm to reach out for my water glass. It wouldn't. I panted with the effort, and the panting took effort. I was about as weak as a newborn child. No, a woman insisted in the other room. It was a voice I recognized, but from where? No, she said again, angrier this time, and then fell silent. It was Bryony Downs.
The meeting was taking place in the next room. It was brazen of her to do it here, to walk into the enemy's stronghold and cut a deal in the place where they had every advantage. She really did think herself invincible. The antidote could be out there, nestled in her pocket. No, she wouldn't have brought it with her, not where it could be taken from her by force. She'd have it hidden somewhere nearby, only giving its location over when she'd gotten what she wanted, if Holmes gave her what she wanted. Which meant, of course, that I would die, and in the next 2 hours. I struggled again to get my legs to obey me. "Move," I told them as laughter pealed in the next room. "Move." The shirt and soft pants I'd been dressed in were already drenched through with sweat. Sweat? Was that a good thing, sweating? Did that mean the nerves and veins inside me, I imagined them now, crackled black and breaking, were still healthy? Was I somehow beating this? If I was beating this, I'd probably have working legs, I reminded myself. Grinding my teeth, I focused on my knees. Move. And I did. I rolled right off the bed and onto the carpeted floor, bringing the bedside table down with me. The crash was tremendous, and I lay in the middle of it, in the spilled pills and scattered tissues and the shards of my drinking glass, helpless. I'd been in denial until that point, I think, but that was when it really hit me, that I was going to die. That they were going to put me in the ground, not years from now, not surrounded by books I'd written in the little flat on the Rue de Rivoli at age 73, but today, in a matter of hours. I'd kissed Charlotte Holmes once, and I would die before I'd see a second time. The door flung open with a bang. "Watson," Holmes said, going down to her knees beside me. "Bring the boy in here," the voice rang out like a sweet bell. "I'd like to see him." "Can you move?" Holmes asked, unnaturally loud. She put her hands under my arms. "If I get you to your feet, can you lean on me?" "Yes," I managed to say, though I had no idea if it was true. She heaved me up to my knees. "Listen to me," she said in my ear. Her black hair brushed against my cheek. "When I blink twice, you play your last card." "Okay," I said, because "I don't know what the hell you're talking about" was seven more words than I could force out. "Milo," she called. "I could use a hand." Together, the two of them manhandled me out of the bedroom and into the sitting room that, when I'd last seen it, had been empty. Under Holmes's direction, Milo's mercenaries had reassembled it into what it had been, which was something like a preppy brothel, a pink shag rug, lucite chairs around a lucite table, a sofa that looked like it had been stuffed with marshmallows, and a pair of men's trousers hung over its arm, an iPod dock and speakers, a haphazard setup of slides and beakers and a microscope. Those must have been Dr. Warner's. A gilt mirror spanned the whole length of one wall, gathering the entire room in its reflection. Charlotte Holmes, in her trim black clothes, sitting on a fuzzy ottoman that looked like it escaped from Fraggle Rock. Milo, so close to his sister that their knees were touching. And me, slumped like a beached whale on one of those clear plastic chairs. If the beached whale had lost 15 pounds overnight, coated his face in Vaseline and blacked his eyes, and then crawled up onto a beach to end it all. Looking at me, Bryony Downs curled her lip in disgust. She'd come in no further than the front door. Her purple puffer coat was unzipped, but she still wore her pom-pommed hat and gloves. With her porcelain doll face, flushed from the cold, she could have been taking a breather from the slopes. Really, everything about her belonged in a catalogue for Fair Isle sweaters or an advertisement for a ski lodge in Aspen. Everything except the fanatical gleam in her eyes. "Hi, Jamie," she said brightly. "It's good to see you." If I hadn't been an hour from death, I would have walked right up to her and snapped her neck. But I was. That was the point. "Okay, where was I? Before this one's attempt to prematurely kick the bucket." She rested against her doorframe, hands in her pockets.
"You were gloating," Milo offered.
"Yes," Holmes said, leaning forward. Do go on. It's fascinating. She had that cataloging look to her, with her fingertips pressed together and that line at the bridge of her nose. I noticed then that there was a briefcase